listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It's the close of a week that began with U.S. President Donald Trump visiting NATO in Brussels, raising questions about the very nature of the Atlantic Alliance. The week closed with Trump visiting the UK, where he faced street protests and a domestic political situation in serious turmoil. Trump is set to sit down on Monday with Russia's President Vladimir Putin, and with all of these moving parts, we decided it was time for a conversation with international affairs analyst Mark Sloboda. He's a retired U.S. naval officer whose academic credentials include a degree from the London School of Economics, and he's now a senior lecturer in international relations at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday. Mark, tell us a little about Trump's latest trip to the continent.
It started off in Brussels, where Trump basically crashed a NATO meeting. I mean, of course, as the president of the U.S., he's the biggest guest there, but he probably did more damage to NATO in a single day than has been done by any, certainly any military bloc in its entire existence.
That's right.
it was quite amusing for us who don't agree with the continued existence of NATO, particularly us military vets who don't agree with the continued existence of NATO. Then Trump jetted across the channel to the United Kingdom, where he is now being protested against by huge crowds in London. And he had a meeting with Theresa May, the unelected Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who is bumbling badly Brexit deal with the EU. And just before Trump arrived, this caused her Brexit secretary and her foreign secretary, Boris Johnson, known affectionately in the United Kingdom as Bojo the Clown. Bojo also quit, saying that Theresa May was making a hash of Brexit and it was ending up to be Brexit in form, in name only, without any substance, and with actually just as beholden to EU laws and regulations, which was, of course, one of the things that those who voted Brexit wanted out of. So while Trump is meeting with this beleaguered Theresa May, who is holding on politically by a lifeline, having just lost two secretaries and so on. He's meeting with Theresa May, something that pretty much both political sides in the United Kingdom have no love for Donald Trump. I mean, I'm sure there's a minority. I know there's a nationalist minority in the United Kingdom, but the vast majority of the people in the United Kingdom, when even the Evening Standard is taking out full pages against his visit and so on, which is a conservative center-right newspaper, then you know that this is pretty much across the board.
This is pretty much the same phenomenon. This is pretty much the same phenomenon we saw in the electoral landscape in the United States during the election, by the way. Not just the Democrats were vehemently against Trump, but so were almost all of the Republican leadership.
Yeah, except in this case, I think it's a large percentage of the British public as well, not just the political elite. So as Trump is meeting with Theresa May, and they're walking in together, I think it was to a dinner, her fumbling at him, trying to get him to hold her hand, which is was quite a comical sight just to watch that. If you want to try to watch Theresa May holding Trump's hand, I'm sure you can find a vid of it online. Trump had given an interview to The Sun, which is essentially a British right tabloid. Certainly not a paper of record. Anyway, he had given a interview to The Sun beforehand, and as he's meeting with Theresa May, this article was published, this interview with him. And during the interview, he said, "Speaking of Mr. Johnson, who resigned this week as foreign secretary in protest over Mrs. May's Brexit strategy, and who has long been seen as a likely to challenge her for her job, Mr. Trump said, 'Well, I'm not going to pit one against the other. I'm just saying I think he,'" meaning Bojo, "right, would be a great prime minister."
Right. No.
"I think he's got what it takes." Yep. "And I think he's got the right attitude to be a great prime minister." He said this while he's meeting with the actual British prime minister.
Exactly.
It's very possible that she could face an internal party challenge from Boris Johnson. And Trump steps right into this. And, you know, the comment, the title I saw from the New York Times was, "With May's government teetering, Trump gives it a shove." Right. And I think that's pretty accurate.
Yep.
I think we got to give the New York Times credit where it is due. And I think that's a pretty accurate title. This is what Trump did. He walked right into this mess that's in the UK, this political mess going on right now. And he just gives it a good shove.
You know, what's interesting, too, if you look at the recent history. Okay, first of all, Brexit, the referendum to exit the EU, on behalf of the UK, won. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, ways to parse the results of that, and also, you know, has that changed? You know, people calling for another one. But the fact is that Brexit won, and that May opposed Brexit while it was pending.
And then
said, "Well, you know, this is what the people wanted, so I will enforce it." Then has mismanaged it, according to just about everybody, certainly according to the supporters of Brexit. And now you're seeing, Johnson and May's main person handling Brexit resigning over the past few days over the, essentially the fact that Brexit hasn't happened, hasn't moved forward, and, isn't shaping up in the way that people think, that was chosen by the voters. So they're all kind of bailing on May and her handling of it at the same time that Trump shows up. And so it's kind of an interesting political configuration. The whole landscape is kind of in flux there. And so when he's pushing, he's not just going to push her so she slips and falls, but maybe so the whole apparatus tips over some.
Yeah, and we've got to remember that, the vote went to Brexit, and that was actually a surprise to almost everyone.
Right.
Most people were predicting a 5% swing the other way. Instead, right. It was a 5% swing towards Brexit.
Right.
And, of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that half the British population supports it. It's the half that voted,
that's
which,
right.
In a democratic section, that's what counts.
Right.
So while just over half of, the British population supported Brexit, the other half virulently opposed it. Virulently.
Right.
And this is particular the liberal urban cosmopolitan population, which means the population of London. And that's where Trump, of course, is sitting down in the middle of this. This is Remain. Territory. This is Remain right. territory that he's in London, and he has already had various Twitter wars with the Muslim mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, that have over the issue of Islam and immigration and so on. So he's sitting down also into the middle of this, and so during the protests today, quite. A wonderful showcase of the British liberal public's political maturity. This puerile stunt. They've got a giant orange Trump baby blimp flying
right.
over the protests today. And I expect the protest to be quite large, which is really quite amusing because other than rhetoric, there is so very little that Trump has done that Obama wasn't already doing.
Right. You mentioned how divided the vote was. Nationally. It looks like Democrats and Republicans nationally in the United States. You had 51.89% voted leave, 48.11% yep. voted to remain. In other words, Brexit, no Brexit. You have London and the other, essentially where the upper middle class and the managerial class live, voting to remain. They're sort of a cosmopolitan kind of, worldview. Not the internationalist, but the globalist view of things.
Yes.
And those who are skeptical of that and either looking back or looking beyond to their regaining sovereignty were opposed. Now, he's in the middle of London, which was the bastion of the Remain vote on the one hand. So the vote, the protesters are definitely going to turn out there. And like you mentioned, they're polarized like Democrats and Republicans are here. If Chuck Schumer were to give a speech in some Midwest city, you would have all the Republicans that were sitting there turning out to protest him, like you do when Trump goes into some place like New York or whatever.
Yes.
But what's interesting, some of the contradictions are when the Brexit vote was held in 2016, Boris Johnson was the mayor of London.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the proponents of Brexit.
He was the biggest proponents of Brexit.
That's right. And Trump also, internationally, was probably the only one who not only accepted the fact that the Brexit vote, was legitimate, but also said, "And hey, by the way, it's a good thing."
Yeah, he did. He did quite famously say that, and
yep.
he has talked about crafting some type of special trade deal with the United Kingdom to compensate for the lack of relationship with the EU,
right.
which the Brexiteers jumped at, but that hasn't really amounted to much except for Trump giving tariffs that
right.
have affected the United Kingdom as much as they have other countries.
Right.
In his trade war on the world, essentially, as it's going right now.
Yeah.
I think Well, of course, we don't know the result of that. Trump may be savvy enough to understand that actually his voice of support for Boris Johnson with the British public would actually go the other way and right. would actually tank Boris Johnson.
Right.
And Boris Johnson has had some rather public unkind things to say about Trump
right.
before.
That's right.
I don't know how self-aware Trump is on his the opinion of him with the British public. I have an unfortunate tendency, I think, sometimes to underestimate the man. But how much he's aware of other countries' political situation, I'm not sure.
Well, the one last thing I would say on this point about Trump is that, you know, from one last thing I have to do is when Brexit won, the first words that we heard out of the political elite here under the uh-oh column was, Trump could win. If Brexit won, Trump could win. Right.
Yeah. So, that of course proved to be the case. And that just shows that, you know, the liberal political elite, you know, which includes the media and pundits and everything, you know, have repeatedly underestimated nativist, anti-globalist, populist. You know, we use that word populist, meaning the people who have been hurt by neoliberal economic globalization.
Right.
Populist is somewhat is this demissive word. You know, what is the opposite of populist? Elitist?
Yeah. right. I know.
I certainly don't believe that anything Trump is doing is actually going to make the economic situation of you know, the people that have been adversely affected by neoliberal capitalist globalization. Now, he's not going to bring their jobs back to the Rust Belt. And I think there was some self-awareness of that. I heard interviews in the U.S. and in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan that they knew – Or at some level, there were some interviews that said, we know that Trump isn't actually going to be able to do much for us, but he spoke to us. He's the only one who
right.
even acknowledged that globalization has hurt us, because
right.
part of the whole propaganda supporting globalization, oh, it's better for everyone, and you can just retrain and get a better job in the city, you know.
Right, that's right.
All right, as a 50-year-old, laborer, you know, used to working in heavy industry, which is of course ridiculous. The
right.
globalization has had winners, it has had lots of them, and it has had lots of losers too.
Millions. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, and you know, the liberals who, you know, and neoliberals on the Republican side, you know, who supported this all the way, they have always neglected those people, and Trump tapped into that. You know, however unfairly, however he may not in any way be a champion who can help them in any way. You know, and Brexit is a parallel vote that happened in the United Kingdom, because again, it was largely a vote on many ways over globalization and how Britain was tied into the economy and the globalist economy through it, and the loss of sovereignty that Britain faced to the European Union, which is the penultimate neoliberal institution. And
yeah.
And speaking of the EU, if we just go back a day to the NATO summit in Brussels, where Trump blew in, already having voiced his opinion many times that he thinks that NATO is an antiquated organization that serves no purpose in today's, you know, post-Cold War world,
right.
You know, which Trump, you know, like the proverbial clock, he's right twice a day. And of course, he
right.
again, right on this.
Right.
But he has been demanding that NATO members live up to the long-standing a guideline that NATO members should spend 2% of their GDPs on their militaries, on what they call defense spending. And there's only 8 out of 29 members of the NATO that actually do that. And the U.S., of course, is one of them, spending far over that amount.
Right.
And The remainders are the United Kingdom, Poland, a couple of Baltic countries, and most of those have and Greece and Turkey, which are spending money on arms against each other, of course.
Right, which is insane.
And Germany and Greece, which is mandated by its bailout deals with Germany and the rest of the EU to buy arms from them. We'll give you some money to bail it out, but you have to spend this percentage of it on weapons that you actually don't really need. To help our own domestic arms industries, which is really a sin if I've ever heard one. So Trump blew in, demanded, not only is he demanding quite loudly that not only do they work towards meeting that 2% goal, but they meet it immediately.
Right.
And then when there was, you know, some polite befuddled pushback from this from Jen Stoltenberg, he said during the interview that Germany starts attacking Germany, and he says that Germany is a captive of Russia,
right?
Because they are continue to get energy from Russia, and they have signed a deal which is still not 100% finalized for this Nord Stream 2, this pipeline to go under the Baltics that will bring Russian gas directly to Germany, another Nord Stream 2 pipeline, of course bypassing the troublesome transit countries of the Ukraine in particular, also Poland. Germany is always looking to increase its use of gas as it moves away from coal, to try to be a little bit more environmentally friendly in its energy mixture.
Right.
But it's using increasing amounts of Russian gas. And Trump said that makes them a captive country. And he doesn't understand why the United States should continue to pay more of its military to defend Germany against Russia when Germany is cutting deals, energy deals, and building pipelines with Russia.
Well, the specific thing that he said had an interesting internal logic to it. And he was saying basically, because you have Russia, which has the natural gas easily available through this pipeline once it's constructed. Very logical in terms of delivery. There's no added, fossil fuel weight, like shipping natural gas by boat from the United States. It's not fracked. It's not fracked. It's not destroying, water supplies on the ground. Environmentally, it makes much more sense to do it. Economically, it makes much more sense to do it because the overhead is so much lower because of the location. You know, physically, it makes much more sense because of the proximity. And so Trump is saying, however, you're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to Russia instead of paying it to us. And now you want us to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to defend you from Russia. Don't make no sense. That's what Trump was saying. And it's an interesting statement.
Yeah, it is. Well, in a way, he's actually right, of course.
Right, exactly.
Right. Because it points out the absolute contradiction.
Exactly.
Of course, Russia is no military threat, not a conventional military threat to Germany. Russia's
our economic competitor. Germany. That's what he's saying. They're not a military threat. They're our economic competitor, and that's what NATO's for.
And he's absolutely right about that.
Yep.
Russia is not going to invade the Baltics. Right. They haven't done anything against the Baltics. They're not going to, run over Poland. My God, you would have to pay Russia to take Poland.
Yeah,
they're
right.
quite happy to let that political problem fester in on the EU, own, where Poland has lots of disagreements, of course, with the EU government in Brussels.
Right.
But Trump's angle on all of this, of course, is not that. It's that, and when you stop buying Russian gas, you then buy our more expensive
fracked gas.
Liquefied natural gas, which has to be processed at a port at a high cost, shipped much more unreliably than a pipeline across the ocean,
tankers,
and then deprocessed at the other end.
Right.
It makes it much more it would make it very economically uncompetitive for Germany's export-orientated government to start using U.S. liquefied natural gas.
Right.
And he said, on top of it, and you buy more of our weapons, you buy more weapons, because Germany is one of the biggest countries that is not meeting by quite a substantial amount its 2% goal.
Right.
And he said, and you can meet your 2% goal and buy those weapons from us on top of it.
Right.
So right. he's essentially his angle is that of a thug of a protection racket.
Right. That's true. But said, and then another contradiction this whole thing sits on top of, however, and see, somebody around Trump must know these facts that we're discussing. You cannot just willy-nilly in Germany in particular, but also more particularly in places like Greece, Italy, Spain, France, Spain, Portugal, you know, the places that are really looking at austerity since at least 2008. You can't turn around and tell the public there, look, I know we took away your pensions. I know we've been closing schools and hospitals. I know you're, you know, starving and in foreclosure, but we're going to have to pull out some more of the safety net so that we can pay more money to NATO to protect us from Russia. Doing that is going to put people in the streets, and some of those countries, it may actually end up toppling them. You know, that's the political situation on the ground in Europe.
Now, Russia threat, Russia threat, Russia threat. Meanwhile, it's NATO that is massing troops on Russia's borders, right? It's not Russian troops in Mexico, right?
Right.
It's U.S. troops on the border with Russia, you know, essentially in violation of previous treaties, permanently stationed. They try to say they're not breaking that by having the troops rotate out and new troops rotate in, which of course Russia finds just offensive, right?
Right.
And the EU countries alone of NATO spend four times what Russia does on their military every year.
Right.
The United States alone spends more than 11 times what Russia does on its military every year. Even the U.S. ally Saudi Arabia is now spending alone more money
than
Russia is on its military every year.
Yeah.
But Russia threat, Russia threat, Russia threat.
Also, what's interesting about the Russia threat, you had in 1989... Russia occupying militarily, like the U.S. occupies Europe now, all the way up to Russia's borders, Russia occupying up the center of Germany, more or less, and Russian troops stationed throughout Eastern Europe, you know, in terms of battle plan against if there's a war with Western Europe and the United States. Now, that whole frontier has moved to Russia's borders. So in terms of a Russian threat, quote unquote, it is the smallest that it's been since actually 1917 or whenever the 20s when the Baltics came into the USSR.
Yeah. And the reality of this is that Russia is no threat to NATO, to the EU. It's not going to invade any European country. This is all about Ukraine. This is all about, this is all a consequence, and all this noise is what it's about, is that, you know, the countries of the U.S. and the EU, they openly backed a putsch with what was a Banderite fascist vanguard, overthrow a democratically elected, if flawed, government in Ukraine that was elected by the people of East and South Ukraine, overthrew that, and then begin a war to subjugate the east of the country, to this new seizure of power, which they didn't accept because they had elected Yanukovych previously specifically to prevent these people, not because they loved Yanukovych or because Yanukovych was corrupt free. Yanukovych was corrupt, every previous government, and Ukraine was corrupt. The new West-backed regime is just as, if not more, corrupt. That's Ukraine. They didn't elect him because he wasn't corrupt. They elected him because he was supposed to represent the interests of the ethnic Russian and Slovak Ukrainian East Ukraine, which is heavy industry, Russian speaking, and so on. It's identity issues, East-West identity issues in Ukraine, and the guy they elected was overthrown with open Western support and orchestration, with the biggest display of meddling that you can possibly imagine, with U.S. and EU politicians flying into the center of Kiev, Independence Square, cheering on crowds that were calling for revolution, and then starting up and funding propaganda outlets supposedly instrumental to the Maidan. I'm talking about Hromadske in particular here. That was openly funded by the U.S. and Dutch State Departments, whose constant tagline on the station 24 hours a day was Revolutia, which is revolution, right? I mean, I'm sorry, that was an openly U.S.-backed push. There's an U.S. and EU pact. There's no question about that.
You have John McCain and you have Nuland and all these people sitting at the head of, on a stage in front of tens of thousands of people that are running out and burning things down and killing people.
I mean, they were, throwing hundreds, thousands of Molotov cocktails a day, seizing government buildings. And there were some pro-EU liberals among them. And there was a lot of far-right ultra-nationalists who were right there with them. When John McCain and Victoria Nuland are doing photo ops with Oleg Tyanybok, the leader of Svoboda.
Goose stepping his way in,
Which was described even in Western mainstream press as fascist, and it was actually condemned in EU Council, EU Council reports. They're saying that no one who supports democracy should support this party, because they're xenophobic and anti-Semitic and far right and everything. Until they did, because it was geopolitically possible for them to flip the Ukraine. Right. But Russia resists against this, right? It gives the people of East Ukraine in Donbass what they need to defend themselves in terms of money and arms, just like the West was giving to, and has propped up the government, the new regime in Kiev.
Right.
And it helps the Crimea, which was almost entirely pro-Russian, the chance to hold a referendum to rejoin Russia, because that's where Russia's Black Sea Fleet was still based.
Right. Sure.
Through agreements reached with the Ukraine that had just been renewed, Russia wasn't going to lose this permanent military port, not to mention the pro-Russian population there, because of this West-backed push.
I'd like to do when we talk next week is take a look at the upcoming visit, which is the big event, the summit between Presidents Trump and Putin. Thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure, as always, Mark.
Okay, thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. If you're a political news junkie, then you're probably experiencing a serious overdose. Consider the recent NATO meeting, Trump's visit to the UK, so-called Russiagate heats up, and the Trump-Putin summit. We discuss it all here on Crosstalk. Crosstalking Summit. I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Eric Krauss. He is an independent political risk analyst. And we have Xavier Moreau. He's the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. Okay, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Eric, there's too much to talk about this week. As I said in my introduction, I mean, we're kind of overdosing on all of this here. I think what's really most important, we can just sum up the last few days of Trump's visit to NATO and then to the UK, his reception, and did he achieve very much?
Mr. Trump is a bit of a loose cannon, and he likes keeping people off balance. He will one day give a warm praise, and the next day absolutely tear them apart.
Well, he did that in the UK with Theresa May.
He did it in the UK. You've got to understand there's method to his madness. Mr. Trump is a traveling salesman. Mr. Trump has one real interest in life, which is to enhance American sales of arms and energy. He wants all the Europeans to massively overspend on defense, defense against whom we don't know.
So I can get that to my point here, Mark. So it's not about security.
Yeah, at least not from Trump's point of view.
Okay.
And I think the contradiction of Trump pointing out that Germany is talking about Russian threat while they're also cutting billion-dollar gas deals with Russia points out the internal contradiction on that, whether Trump intended it or not. But I agree with Eric, absolutely. Trump is a businessman, right? And he doesn't think in terms of geopolitics or American hegemony. He thinks in terms of pluses and minuses of a balance sheet. And he sees that there's a huge trade deficit between the U.S. and the EU. Therefore, he wants to correct that any way he can. And that's his priority.
But is that happening? Because Xavier, right after the bluster of it all, I mean, Trump called himself a stable genius, which is quite remarkable for a politician to say, I must say. But Macron came right out afterwards and said, well, we really didn't agree to anything, okay? I mean, yeah. Again,
satisfied, especially by himself. But I would like to underline the fact that Berlin and Paris are always talking about create an independent Europe of defense. So I was waiting the moment when Angela Merkel or Macron are going to answer to Trump, so we don't want to pay more, so Get back your NATO, and we are going to buy our at least independent European of defense.
Yeah, but Xavier, if that were to come to pass, I tend to think there'd be a reassessment of threats, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah.
And then they'd say, well, do we really need to spend this kind of money here? I mean, this is the wrinkle right here, yeah. Eric, is that if you really step back and say, what is the real threat to Europe? Then their defense would be commensurate to that, not what the NATO paradigm is today.
This is the fundamental problem, contradiction of NATO. It was an alliance against the Warsaw Pact. It was meant to fight conventional war. And as always, generals were fighting the last war, not the next war. It was meant to fight a conventional land war with tanks and artillery in Eastern Europe. Now, this is about as likely as a replay of the War of the Roses or the 30 Years' War. It's not going to happen. The next Third World War is going to last 45 minutes. And we won't have time to get it on TV. So basically, there is no real purpose. The purpose is to keep the arms, the military-industrial complex working.
The thing is that, Mark, I can understand where NATO comes from. There's a lot of people that work there and a lot of people that have jobs there. But the real problem here is, and again, Trump is kind of right for the wrong reason, is that NATO is unable, at least the European members, are unable to reimagine a defense security architecture. They're satisfied with what they have now.
Well, I think that's part of the problem, is that it isn't a defense architecture at all. Richard Sakwa said, he called it a fateful geopolitical paradox, that NATO exists primarily to manage the risks created by its own existence.
Now, wonderful quote.
That is, if you go by the standard rationale, collective security, keep Russia out, etc., NATO hasn't been used that way in decades. NATO has become a political fig leaf, a tool for U.S. military hegemony around the world. Jens Stoltenberg pointed it out himself in response to Trump,
the head of NATO
pointed out exactly this week. He says that if you, it's a European part of NATO's military usage to the United States is in perception, that the use of U.S. military force around the world becomes much more acceptable in the eyes of the rest of the world when it's done through the filter of a coalition within NATO. It is a political fig leaf for U.S. military aggression.
No, because the UN has been pushed aside. Right?
So now you have to remember that before the Ukraine crisis, the main goal of NATO, if you look at the meeting in 2012-2013, was the fight against piracy.
Piracy, okay. Yes.
Yes, that's
and
all.
Terrorism.
That's all. So
yeah.
You have a big, a huge...
Around Somalia, right?
A okay. huge military okay. alliance for that. And I couldn't agree more that it's a political institution. The militarization of European space mm-hmm. by putting some U.S. bases is a way to politically control all this space. It's a really no more military...
Yeah, but the thing is that, I'm always a big advocate of sovereignty here, but, you know, under the NATO paradigm, the NATO countries are surrendering a lot of their sovereignty here. Yeah. But the way Trump is doing it, it's all a package deal, as we've said before. Energy, tariffs, and security. For him, it's all one thing. Okay, and once you start fiddling with one of those three, then it starts to unravel. And this is what the elites in Europe do not want to have happen.
It's the Corleone family. We have a deal for you, but it's a package deal. We own you. The European elites are fairly pathetic. I'm sorry to say that I have seen the deterioration, I'm a French national, and I have seen the deterioration of the governance of my country over the last few years, which is...
Isn't that because politics is really technocratic now? I mean, there's one charismatic figure in the West right now, and believe it or not, it's Donald Trump. I mean, these other people don't inspire much.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, we don't understand how Macron came to power. The election was Fillon's to win. Previous to Fillon, of course, it was the head of the IMF who got caught in a setup in New York City. And then Mr. Fillon was removed by a sudden scandal with somebody pulled out of a hat. And who is it who knows where all the skeletons are hidden in Europe? Who is spending tens or not hundreds of billions of dollars?
Eric, that presupposes that it doesn't... Does it matter who's president of France? Does it matter who's the prime minister of the UK?
To some extent,
I don't think so now.
Yeah.
Anymore.
You know, in my opinion, the most important thing is something that we used to forget. It's ideology.
Right.
There is a pro-Western ideology.
Dima Babic isn't here today to talk about that.
And Macron is just the product, and I agree with you. It's a product of this ideology. He's here to make the system go on. And for me, it's a French Gorbachev. You know, it's the last chance for this elite who live well in France,
state America, officer. We call it zip codes. You never see the immigrants. You never see
Macron,
the drugs and the crime and all that.
Speaking of the deterioration of European Union officials at this NATO summit in Brussels, Jean-Claude Van Juncker walking around. He was toasted off his butt, or if you believe the official version, he has back problems. All right, anyone to watch repeated videos again and again of this man junk. I mean, he's the president of the European Commission, and I think he's a perfect metaphor for the European Union today. Okay. Back in the day, they used to mock the geriatric leaders of the Soviet Union. Brezhnev and Andropov for having to be propped up.
Yeltsin being dead
in front of the masses.
We only got a couple minutes left in this block here. I want to ask you: Is the Western North Atlantic Alliance? It's changing. Is it forever changed, Mark? I mean, there's no going back to the status quo.
Absolutely, there is.
There is.
Yeah. Europe just intends to wait Trump out. Whether it's 2 years or 4 years or it might give
them
a heart
attack. Now we can bring up another Soviet analogy, stagnation. That's what we're going to go for.
They believe they can just wait Trump out and it will be back to the
same. I think it's changing.
In the last European treaty in Lisbon, it's clear that it's a statement 43 that no independent policy of defense without NATO. So he can do. Trump can say what he wants. He will win on this.
Well, he thinks he can pull the U.S. out of NATO all by himself. I don't know. Maybe he can.
I think we're missing the fundamental story here, which is that we are living in a period of accelerated transition. We had a single empire, which was highly successful, which in 1945 controlled almost 50% of global GDP. Currently controls about 18%. Is now the world's second largest economy. Let that sink in. China, by in PPP terms, according to the World Bank, is the world's largest. There is a shift in the center of gravity, and what we are seeing and what we're talking about are symptoms. The real driving force is the change and the change of the dominant empire. And from a Russian standpoint, the ideal situation for Russia was a balancing act between East and West. West has rendered that impossible. So Russia's orientation is now going to become much closer, much more tightly tied
off of China.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. This is a very nice segue to what I want to talk about in the second half of the program. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with Art.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, Eric, I want to go to you. Before we talk about the summit in Helsinki, you wanted to make a point.
Basically, I was sort of looking at the American media coverage of this, and I was seeing an article in the New Yorker, which used to be a liberal, relatively pacifistic, intelligent East Coast publication, and it has now gone full on propagandistic. And if you look at the American media, you now basically have, as far as I can see, three factions. You have the DNC, which the Democratic National Group, which is still arguing with the referee 18 months after the final whistle was blown. They're still arguing. They lost the election. You've got to get on and try to fight the next one. You've got Fox News with all that represents and always has represented. That hasn't changed very much.
The Koch brothers.
Yeah, that's right. And then you've got the military-industrial complex, which is making a lot of
money. So that's CNN and MSNBC.
Yes, that's the mainstream. And there is no independence of any of them. And the problem is that they want to score points against Trump, whatever it costs own country.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad you brought this up. This is by Susan B. Glasser, and it's the amateur boxer up against Muhammad Ali. Washington fears Trump will be no match for Putin in Helsinki.
Now,
this is a very interesting. I'm glad you made it. You made me aware of it, Mark. But this is a perfect example of a low octane intelligence getting. No, it's certainly. I mean, she's no sharp knife in the drawer. Okay, not by any standard. But this is the swamp. This is a swamp article, okay? And it really is. And Eric's right. It's against. If it's against Donald Trump, then it's perfectly fine. But it has nothing to do with the geopolitical interest of the United States.
Interesting that 18 years ago, the same medias were explaining that Putin is a stupid colonel of KGB, and now he's Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. Now he's Muhammad Ali. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting. The title that she took of this, that Trump is an amateur boxer fighting Muhammad Ali is supposedly a quote from an anonymous former State Department official.
Of course.
Right? Like the usual
anonymous source.
Retreads from the blob, the deep state coming back. Right. What this article shows us, and it's a good one to read.
Although, it is a good one to read.
If you flick through the New Yorker's articles this week, it is just one among many in a similar vein. They're terrified of this summit because they and we, it must be said, do not know what Trump will do at this summit. There is no agreed upon reason for this summit other than to have a summit, the idea of starting to talk. But usually when there's a summit between the leaders of the U.S. and Russia, there are months of preparatory work. Low-level officials on various issues go back and forth. They debate the issues. They make compromises.
Trump flies by the seat of his pants.
Right?
I think there's a method to this madness here. I think Trump wants to make sure he's going to have the summit he wants, and not what John Bolton wants, not what Pompeo wants, not what always confused Nikki Haley wants. He's going to have his own.
They're terrified that when he goes into that room with just interpreters and his deep state handlers not there, to handle him, what he might do. We don't know what he might do. But they're terrified of that possibility. And him threatening that Germany, that they're a captive of Russia, right? When the opposite is actually far closer to truth. Or threatening to pull out of NATO, right? Just in the last week.
They are in the United Kingdom, where he's having a discussion with the Prime Minister and saying that Boris Johnson Bojo would make a great Prime Minister too.
Exactly, but I don't see what either side can give to the other. I don't see anything. Okay. No. Because there's well, maybe because there's no preparation for it, but I don't see.
There is preparation.
There
is no preparation. In my opinion, we will have good results, but this result we will know after the midterm November election. What need know Trump is having a triumph after his meeting with Putin for a local election.
Americans don't care about foreign policy.
And second one.
But we do know. But Mark, but be careful. We have indications that his base would like to see better relations with Russia. That's why he's pushing it.
Only because he pushes it.
And we go full circle here. Everything he says for his base. It's not about security. It's not about economics. It's not about anything except for himself and his base. Eric, go.
The problem in the American media at this point is that if Mr. Trump tomorrow announced that he had a meeting lined up with the Holy Ghost, within 24 hours, the New York Times would be saying the Kremlin has suborned the Holy Trinity and they're working for Russia. And they don't care. And this is a very dangerous situation.
So God's a Democrat, I guess, right?
This is a very dangerous situation for any country when the domestic political players are more interested in harming each other than in furthering the national interest. This is when you get civil wars.
Mark, it looks with that the indictment of the alleged 12 Russian intelligence officials here. I mean, I think all of us think that the timing of that is quite peculiar, to say the least.
I mean, it's obvious. Okay? It's a political message, right? It comes right on the heels of the Strzok hearings in Congress.
What entertainment that was, okay?
Just before the summit. It's obviously a political attempt to derail the summit, right?
But I'm glad you know, one of the things I think is really important, I'm glad you brought that up, because we can, and I watched the talking heads dissect that testimony from Peter Strzok. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. But yeah, okay, but beyond the optics, too. But what was interesting, and I think this is, we've talked about on this program many times, the crisis of institutions. This, really, what is it really at the crux of all of this here is the separation of powers. Mm-hmm. Is that the FBI and the DOJ are defying Congress. This is not trivial. This is not trivial at all. And I think this is where it's coming. And Strzok, still being an employee of the FBI, gets the shield of the protection of the FBI. Once he's out, we'll see what happens to him. And his girlfriend, Lisa Page, looks like she's going to be okay. Okay, we'll see that next week here. But there's an institutional crisis here.
Actually, it's the same in France. You were talking about the Macron election. It's the same in Brasilia. It's the same in Spain.
It's a coup d'état.
It's a coup d'état. It's a permanent coup d'état. And let's see how the U.S. will go through this crisis, because it's, of course,
Eric, you were mentioning no matter what is said during this summit, Trump's not going to get any credit for it. I mean, it doesn't matter the outcome, even if there's no outcome.
Well, and you said it. He's going to get credit with his base. Basically, Trump is going to, like with Kim, he's going to come out, he's going to announce a major victory, a great step forward for American security. They'll come up with some sort of deal. My guess, and it's only a guess, and Mark will probably disagree, is that Putin will give something about Iran in Syria. We'll see. I think he'll agree that
Why would he do that?
Because
and number two, Eric, why should Vladimir Putin and the Russian political elite trust Donald Trump?
He doesn't have to trust him. He's not giving away the keys to the Kremlin.
I agree with Eric.
So, God.
Shocking! Shocking!
One of the things that they're discussing that could be could be on the table is a deal in Syria. We know Trump wants to pull out of Syria. His own military has been preventing him. One of the areas in particular is this Al-Tanf base in the south. Basically, it's a desert area. There's very few rebels left there. Most of them have been trained and transferred to the east.
A token concession?
It's a token, but it's important. It's a highway there. So part of the idea, what the Americans are so furious about now is the president, meaning
the Israelis and the Saudis are furious about now, wag the American dog, is that the Iranians are in Syria. Well, if they didn't want the Iranians in Syria,
then why did you try to overthrow 31 flavors of jihad?
Spend 6 years, right? And that's exactly why the Iranians are in Syria. You know, it's a lesson they already learned from Iraq.
Putin is trying to preserve his relationship with Israel to some extent.
And Saudi Arabia as well.
Yes. Yeah, and in Saudi Arabia. But
this is diplomacy.
So the idea is that they might offer Putin gets Iran to back down out of southern Syria, and in return, the U.S. gives up a military base that it has in Syria that it has no use for anymore.
Let's not forget that there is a legitimate government in Syria. They have to be on board too.
All Putin and Syria have to do is promise, oh, sure, the Iranians will be gone. The Americans give up the military base, and then next week the Iranians can be wherever they want.
Okay, Xavier, you're an expert on Ukraine. Is Ukraine going to play any role in this summit, do you think?
In my opinion, First, Trump has a bill against Ukraine with the Manafort affair, and we saw what he did with Macron.
Trump does not love the regime in Kiev.
Yes, yeah, and very interesting declaration of
Tusk. How much money did the Ukrainian oligarchs give to the Trump campaign? I don't think any. Okay, but I think they did a lot with the Clinton campaign.
Tusk gave an interview on a Polish newspaper, and he told that he had some discussions with Trump, and Trump very well understand the Kremlin position on Ukraine, but he doesn't understand what Kiev really wants, as a politically speaking. So first, Trump has a bill against the Kiev government. And secondly, we don't have to forget that Russia is not a competitor for US. Germany is, of course. And so actually, the average level of trading between Russia and the United States, it's all 2% GDP for both sides. So it's almost nothing. So actually, if Trump is really this pragmatic guy who wants to make America a great industrial country power again, so he has just only interest to find an agreement with Russia.
The summit might be just for him to make him great for history. Okay?
On the first step, let's see after November, we will know what will be the result. Because there is some actually very serious discussion between the US and the Russian part. But again, in my opinion, we won't have any official result.
In November, 10 seconds,
very interesting language. Trump says Russia is a competitor. John McCain rises from his deathbed to say that, that Russia is an enemy.
Putin, through his
spokesman, says, no, I think quite trolling. No, Trump is our partner.
Okay. On that point, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.